You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, episode number 166. If you accept the pain, it cannot hurt you. Wolverine.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft. It's the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. Today's show is also sponsored by Indie Film Hustle Pro, our private and growing community for filmmakers and screenwriters. It was created for film creatives like you to meet, network, and support each other, learn from film industry experts, and to get the answers to your burning questions and more. The journey in this business is rough. There is no guarantee to success, but your chances of reaching your goals dramatically improve when you find others who are on the same journey as you and you work together towards a common goal. That is why I put together IFH Pro. Inside, you'll get professional networking, private and safe spaces to discuss the film business, access to advanced tools and education, up-to-date education, exclusive content not available publicly, access to IFH Pro workshops, webinars, special guests, and so, so much more. If you want to check it out, head over to indiefilmhustle.com/pro. Now, before I get started, guys, I wanted to officially announce what I have been working on for the last few months. I've invested a ton of time and money in developing the Indie Film Hustle Pro community. I wanted to build a place where filmmakers can get together, talk in a safe, private area to talk about film distribution, to talk about their process, what troubles they're having, and so on. I also wanted to create a community where you could have more access to me, ask me questions. I would be bringing in special guests every month to do Q&As and lectures to the community. You will be able to do AMAs with me twice a month. We have a lot of exclusive content in there, some educational webinars that will be added on every month or so, and so, so, so much more. And I just wanted to find that place, really invest in a community, in a environment where filmmakers can not only learn more, but connect with each other and collaborate and just help each other and find voices that are doing the same thing you are and going through the same struggles that you are. So I really, really hope that you guys love IFH Pro. It will be coming out in the next week to two for early access. And I'm excited to give you guys more information about it. But this is just a tease. So stay tuned for next week, which we're going to be doing a lot more about IFH Pro. And I cannot wait to share the community with you guys. But today on the show, we have writer, producer, and director Simon Kinberg. Now, Simon started off his career in, like all screenwriters, he sold his first screenplay out of film school while he was still in film school, and was going to the set of the movie that he had sold the script for while he was still in school, which starred two of the biggest movie stars of all time and directed by one of the hottest directors of all time. And from that point on, his career launched, as you could imagine. He is responsible for working on films like Sherlock Holmes, X-Men, X-Men Days of Future Past, producing Deadpool, Deadpool 2, bringing one of the best superhero genre films of all time, in my opinion, Logan, to the screen, and much more. We discuss his writing process, his directing process, what it's like to work within the studio system, and we also discuss his new film, The 355, starring Jessica Chastain, Penelope Cruz, and an amazing cast of Oscar-winning actors as well. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Simon Kinberg. First of all, how did you get started in the business, in the film industry in general?
I got started, I was in film school, graduate film school at Columbia in New York, and I wrote a script in my first year of film school that a professor of mine named Ira Deutschman, who was the creator of Fine Line Features and produced a lot of movies, he read, he liked, he optioned for $1.
Nice.
And with the promise that he would send it out to Hollywood, to studio executives and agents and managers and the like, to start my career. And it did. I got my agent at CAA, where I remain represented. I got my lawyer, who's still my lawyer, and a lot of relationships that are still some of the closest professional relationships in my life. And those people, I was 23 at the time, and those people were maybe a little older than I am. And those people now run studios. Those people are Scott Stuber and Donna Langley and Emma Watts. And I mean, those are, you know, we all started as kids together and now we're no longer kids. So that's how I started. And then I continued in film school, even though I was, you know, getting this traction and working in Hollywood. And then my thesis project in my second year of film school was a script called Mr. and Mrs. Smith. And that obviously turned into a movie starring Brad and Angelina. And from that point forward, my career really, really catapulted to a different level.
So one of your first scripts gets picked up and is a big Hollywood production with two of the biggest movie stars of all time out of film school, essentially.
That is accurate. and was completely absurd and surreal. And you know, listen, making that movie would have been surreal in any circumstance. If I was making
at any age. Yeah, at any age.
But when you're 20 something years old and you're on your first film set, and you're showing up to work every day, and in the morning you're working with Brad and Angelina on lines, and Vince Vaughn and Kerry Washington and Doug Liman, who was about as hot as any director could be because he'd gone from Swingers to Go to Born Identity to our film. It was, I wouldn't even say it's a dream come true because I wouldn't have dared to dream that big. It was a completely like absurdist fantasy. It felt like I was in a Charlie Kaufman movie.
Which is, and obviously anyone listening, that's generally the way it works for screenwriters. This is the normal road that all screenwriters go through.
Correct? Oh yeah, of course. Yeah, and when people tell me, they say, what advice do you have? I said, just sell a movie and get the biggest movie stars in the world to act in it. And then you're golden, you're done.
Then everything just the doors open magically.
Yeah, of course.
Now, what is your writing process? Like, do you sit down, I mean, every day at a certain time? Do you wait for inspiration, the muse to show up? Do you argue with the muse? Why aren't you here? Things like that.
I love these questions. The answer to your question is my writing process is everything you described. But it starts with, I have a set amount of hours each day that I'm going to write, because if I don't have that kind of construct or that kind of discipline, the muse is never going to show up. I don't think the muse just magically shows up. Sometimes it magically shows up while you're sleeping or you're in the shower or your subconscious is working, right? But what it needs is some sort of container. And then within that container of however many hours I'm gonna sit down and write per day, and I have a goal of how many pages I'm gonna get done or how many scenes I'm gonna get done. But that goal, sometimes I surpass it, most times I come short of it. Then you just wrestle all day. The writing is the greatest torture in the world, and it is the greatest pleasure in the world when you get it right. When the muse shows up and a line comes out of nowhere and you don't know where it came from, and if not for you, it would not have existed, and it cracks something open, it's the greatest feeling in the world. And the other 99.9% of the time, you are staring at a white page or a white wall and saying, why did I take this job? Why did I choose this career? I could have been a professor. I would have been a happier person. That's my writing process. I mean, my technical or specific writing process, I would not advocate for anyone, including myself, but it just happens to be mine, which is I write by hand. And I write on blank white pieces of paper, front and back. And I don't know what page I'm on when I'm writing the script. I just know a sense of sort of flow and rhythm of storytelling. And what it helps me with is, one, I'm just much looser because it's not on a computer and I don't feel like there's a sort of finality to what I'm writing. And it's got scribbles and scratches and you'd never be able to read it anyway. But it also, it keeps me from going backwards. It keeps me from looking at yesterday's work because I can barely read yesterday's work. I just keep moving forward. And there's a satisfaction of that. If I were to show you a picture, by the time it's done, it's really a lot of pages. And so there's a satisfaction of building that pile as I'm writing. And that's better than being able to scroll up and down a screen for me.
Now, you know, as writers, you know, I know when I'm writing, I feel sometimes that like I'm typing and then afterwards I read and I go, who wrote that? Like, I don't even remember writing that. Do you have that feeling of almost channeling some other worldly force, that thing that writers, if we're lucky enough to tap into, flows through you? Is that your experience?
Yeah. I mean, that's the 0.001% of the time. That's the unbelievable joy. You know, when people ask me what's my favorite part of my job, and I've done a lot of different aspects of this job between producing and directing and writing, and the greatest pleasure for me by far and away are the moments you're describing, where as a writer you do discover or channel, however you want to describe it, invent, whatever the verb is. It is outside of you, and then it is coming through you, and then it is on a page. And if not for you existing in the world, those lines, that idea would not exist either. And that feeling is the greatest feeling in the entire world. And it is the feeling, you know, there's a joke, and I can only say this joke because I'm a Jew. why did the Jews search in the desert for 40 years? Because they found, I don't know, a dollar. Why did they search another 40 years? Because they found a dollar. And I think that is very much my writing process and all of our writing process, right? Which is like, take forever. We find something that is invaluable and then we take another forever because we're chasing that feeling.
That's the film industry in general. I think as film creatives, you're just always searching for that high that happens a handful of times if you're lucky in your lifetime, whether as a director, as a producer, as a writer, you're looking for that high. Yeah. We're sick. We're all sick as film. I call it the beautiful sickness.
Listen, you know, I say this to my partner all the time. She's a writer too, but a different kind of writer. She's a poet. And I say, you know, if not for the fact that after 6 hours, 8 hours, 10 hours a day, we came out of our rooms with pieces of paper that had writing on it, we would be considered, you know, psychiatric or psychologically, you know, imbalanced and put in a psychiatric hospital, because we would just be sitting in our room for 10 hours a day, staring at the wall, communicating with imaginary voices and characters in our head. And if we didn't somehow experience, you know, you would be that, I'm sure that would be diagnosed. I'm not a psychiatrist, psychologist, but my armchair psychology would be, that would be schizophrenia.
Fair enough.
But you know, we're writers and artists, and so we get away with it.
Now, one of my favorite films in the X-Men series is X-Men Days of Future Past. You know, you wrote that. How did you come up with that storyline? Like, that's an insanely complex storyline, meaning all the moving parts.
Yeah. Well, I came up with it because Chris Claremont came up with it, and you know, it was a comic book. And so the notion of it, was something that had already existed as a comic.
Got it.
But as a comic, it was wildly different than the movie we made. Like as one specific example, it was Kitty Pryde that went back in time, not Wolverine. And one of the reasons I made it Wolverine, other than obviously Wolverine being the lead of the franchise, was because I thought there was something incredibly powerful about this character who had been in some ways tamed by, by Professor Xavier, having to go back to a younger, broken Professor Xavier and tame and teach him the lessons that Xavier had taught him. So there was an inherent complexity, and it was interesting to me about that. But writing that movie, I would say, from a technical standpoint, was the most complicated and difficult film I've ever written, because of the time travel element, because of the time paradoxes, because of the fact that I was playing two different sets of characters who were essentially the older and younger version of the same character,
right.
You know, simultaneously, and wanting to give them all arcs, you know, wanting to give Halle Berry interesting things to play, and certainly wanting to give all of our younger X-Men from X-Men First Class, who were sort of the dominant storyline of that movie, really interesting, surprising twists and turns emotionally in that film, while also servicing a storyline that was itself an unbelievable, demon to wrestle to the ground.
No question. And beyond, like even when you're writing the voices of the same character is so different from the older Xavier to the younger Xavier, and keeping that all together, did you just put it all up on a board? Like, how do you keep not only the characters, but the timelines and the paradoxes? Like, that's why I look at movies like Back to the Future and I'm just like, Jesus, man, how did Bob and Bob do that?
Yeah. I mean, Back to the Future was obviously a movie that I looked at a lot. Terminator 2, sure. I looked at a lot, although there's not as much back and forth, obviously, and the character, you don't have the same kind of struggle with the characters. I have a great actual Terminator 2 story, which is I met James Cameron's one of my idols, like all of us. And I met him, we were on a panel together insanely while I was writing Days of Future Past. And I said to him, listen, I'm writing this time travel movie. And, the Terminator films are, for me, among the greatest time travel movies of all time, obviously among the greatest science fiction movies, maybe movies of all time. And I said, and I had brought this fan book that I had for him to sign.
And, of course.
And so he was like, okay, buddy, I'm going on a panel with you, but I'm happy to sign your book. So I signed, he signed the book. We went on the panel. I looked at the book afterwards and he'd written, Dear Simon, don't fuck it up. Love, James. Throughout the writing of the process of Days of Future Past, I just kept thinking, don't fuck it up. Don't fuck it up. You keep fucking it up with these paradoxes. But I hope I didn't say those words, but otherwise.
Sure.
Yes, I did have, I don't usually use note cardboards when I write, but I did with that because it was so complex. The luxury I had, the advantage I had in writing the older and the younger versions of these characters is that I had already written the older and younger versions of these characters. I'd worked with the older cast in X-Men 3 and had worked with the younger cast on First Class. So I knew the nuances both of the characters and of the actors. Mm-hmm. And so I could channel that to some extent or rely on that to some extent. But even within that, I was creating new versions of those characters, like the young Professor Xavier that McAvoy is playing in Days of Future Past is very different than the McAvoy of First Class, obviously. And the fact that, from the very beginning of the movie, you introduce the older Xavier and the older Magneto as partners and friends. There's a lot of sort of work you're doing to both honor the voices and then also innovate on the voices that came before.
Now, you produced a film that's one of my favorite comic book films of all time, Deadpool, which must have been, I just only assume it must have been a ball to work on that project. At what point did you jump on that project? Was it after the film was leaked by somebody and he got the green light? How was it working on that project?
It was extraordinary working on that project, and it was exactly what you said, which was it was great fun to witness just unbelievably talented people, from the writers, Rhett and Paul, who really created the voice, to Tim Miller, who was directing his first movie, which is incredible to think about. The degree of difficulty tonally of that film is really hard. And then most especially Ryan. Ryan Reynolds is not just the actor of those films or any film he works on. He's the producer. He's he reminds me a lot of the way Tom Cruise works. He's also kind of the person who is operating in every category of the film. He's the sort of force of nature of the movie in the best possible way.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
When I got involved was after the movie had leaked, but before it got greenlit. It was close to getting greenlit, but was not greenlit. And Rhett and Paul, the writers, Wernick and Reese, the writers, emailed me. I'd never met them. And they emailed me saying, we need your, maybe they said, we are Deadpool. We need your ass with a bunch of ellipses after it. And then that was the subject. And then in the body of the email, it continued the word ass into assistance.
what a great way.
Yeah. And they made this this sort of plea to me because I was at that time overseeing the sort of X-Men universe at 20th Century Fox to help them and Ryan and Tim get the movie greenlit. And so we all worked together a bit on the script and then quite a bit in the budget. And one of the things that was extraordinary about that film, especially when you go back and rewatch it, is we made that movie for, I think, something like $50 million.
Yeah, which is low.
It's tiny compared to what your superhero movies are made for, which is usually in the $200 million range. And that was part of the deal with Fox because they'd never made, and nor had most people ever, Marvel hadn't made, they'd made Blade, but they'd never made a true R-rated comic book movie before. And the tone was so wildly anarchic and different and, you know, breaking the fourth wall and all the things that movie does. They said, listen, this is feels like a gamble, but it's a cheap enough gamble that we're willing to take it. And they did. And obviously it paid off incredibly well for everyone involved.
Now, I have to thank you for making Logan, which is arguably one of the greatest, in my opinion, superhero films of all time in the genre. It is. It's like Dark Knight. It's up there with Dark Knight. It's just one of those films. And it's such a bittersweet film. Because I wish Hugh could stay his age forever, just continue to play that character. What was it like? Because you'd been with that character and you've been with Hugh playing that character for so long. What was it like putting that film together and finishing off his swan song, if you will?
It was all the things you said. It was bittersweet because I had lived with Hugh as both a friend and a partner in making these films for probably over a decade. And it was also really exciting because Hugh's ideas, Jim Mangold's ideas, who's a genius filmmaker, Scott Frank's ideas, who's clearly a genius writer. You know, Scott wrote and directed all the Queen's Gambit episodes, and he has such incredible pedigree. We all came together. They all really did the heavy lifting, and Hutch Parker, who is another producer on that, and had worked in a bunch of the X-Men movies and had been the executive at Fox for a lot of them. We all came together and with a common purpose, which is creating, a truly dramatic, truly emotional, deeply resonant swan song for this, you know, character that had been in the zeitgeist for, you know, again, well over a decade, close to two decades. And so it was an extraordinary process with a bunch of, you know, A-plus brilliant human beings taking the job incredibly seriously and just really listening and caring deeply.
Yeah.
Saying when this isn't good enough. And like really, I remember Jim Mangold with that last action sequence and really the third act of the movie just going over and over and over it again, and Scott rewriting it, and me taking a pen through it, and Jim Mangold himself rewriting it, and just like working and working and needing it until we could create something that was worthy of saying goodbye to Hugh in this part that we knew would be hard for people.
Would you, and I have to ask this, will we ever see Hugh in a dead movie, in a Deadpool movie? As a cameo, ever.
I'm not a part of that universe anymore because Disney bought all the Marvel movies at Fox. They bought Fox.
Sure.
The answer is I have no idea. I know, obviously, like the rest of the world does, that Hugh and Ryan are friends and have this sort of rivalry on, you know, fun rivalry.
Beautiful rivalry. Yes.
On social media. So I wouldn't be surprised, but I also have no idea.
Got it. No problem. Now tell me about your new film, The 355, which I had a pleasure of watching yesterday. And it was wonderful. It's just wonderful to see a group of women just kick all sorts of ass throughout the piece. So how did that come to be?
It came to be because it was actually going back to an X-Men movie. When Jessica Chastain and I, we'd worked together on The Martian. And then we worked together on X-Men Dark Phoenix. When we were on the X-Men set, Jessica had this idea to do an all-female ensemble spy movie, and she brought that to me and said, I had this idea, it might sound crazy, and I said, actually sounds really intriguing. And then we just started building it with her producing partner Kelly Carmichael together, and we got the actresses really on that pitch alone, and Jessica's relationships and Jessica's sort of pedigree, and we went to the Cannes Film Festival and we sold it at the Cannes Film Festival to Universal for the UK and US rights as our partners, and then to other distributors at other territories around the world. And from there, we really crafted it to the actresses and built the movie.
You pre-sold it prior to actually going into production?
We pre-sold it way before going into production. Nice. So it all happened very fast. I mean, we pre-sold it at Cannes in 2018, May of 2018, and we were shooting by summer of 2019.
Yeah, and it's been on hold since then because of COVID.
Yeah, we were meant to come out last year, exactly 1 year ago, and that was a tough time for COVID, and obviously we're in another tough time for COVID, but
not a tough time for COVID.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, a different tough time for COVID because we're in a back. Sure. Time and
sure.
Strain is not, it's thankfully quite as lethal as what we were dealing with last year, but yeah, we pushed it a year. It's been done. It could have easily come out last January, and now we finally get to release the film.
Now, how was it directing such remarkable actors? I mean, you've got Oscar winners in there. You've got, I mean, they're powerhouses, every yeah. single one of them. How do you approach directing actors like that as a director?
I approach it the way that I approach kind of directing any actor, which is their partners. You have to go into it that way, and especially with actors like this, because they own their characters more than a director does, because they're living that part, they're wearing that part, they're thinking of that part, and only that part. As a director, there's so many things you're thinking about, right? Not just the characters and the story, but also the visuals and all of the technique of making the film. And with these particular actresses and the actors, Edgar Ramirez and Sebastian Stan, they just had tons of ideas and really an immense amount of authorship and ownership over their characters. And that was part of the process going into all of this, was we were all partners in making the film. And so that's the way I directed them, was, you know, their ideas, my ideas, other people's ideas, other actors' ideas within the scenes with them. We played, it felt like kind of the lovely thing about it. It felt like being in an actor's workshop with the best actors in the world.
Pretty much. Yeah. Now, as the directors, you know, there's always that day that we're on set and the entire world comes crashing down around us, mm-hmm. and we're losing the sun. The crane's not working. The actor can't get to the set for some reason. What was that day for you, either on this film or any of the films you've directed? And how did you overcome that moment as a director?
You know, I think on this film, on 355, the hardest moment, or the moment where I felt like I just want to go home, because you know, you do have that feeling sometimes. Mm-hmm. You know, you're shooting, you know, 50, 60 on a huge movie, 90 days of photography, and they're long hours and all that. On this one, we were filming the fish market sequence, mm-hmm. In an actual fish market. And it was right after the fish market closed, but you could still smell the stink of the fish from that day. And it happened to be quite literally the hottest day in the history of the United Kingdom. And so the smell itself, I think Penelope passed out. I was close to passing out most of the day. It was, you know, sort of before the day of wearing gas masks or surgical masks wherever we went. And so it was overwhelming, and the heat was overwhelming as well. And we had stunts, and we had big crowd sequences. And it just felt like the scale of it, plus the simple, you know, human reality of you're in the stinkiest place imaginable on the hottest day in the history of a country, was a lot to manage. And
you made it through.
I made it through. Luckily, the actors made it through. We all kind of bonded together and helped each other get there.
Now, is there any advice you could give a filmmaker, screenwriter trying to break into the business today?
You know, it's hard because, you know, everybody has a different way into the business. So, you know, I get asked this question a lot, and I hear people asked this question a lot. And I don't want to give like a simple or a singular answer, because again, obviously my path is very different than other people's paths are going to be. And everybody I know who works in the film industry has a different story. The thing I would say is write something you love, direct something you love. I think the mistake that I see a lot of new filmmakers make or new writers make is they write or make something they think is right for the market, or for the zeitgeist, or for, you know, not for themselves. And the truth is you can't chase the market, partly because by the time your movie comes out, the market will have changed already. It takes time. And also because people can feel it. There's enough writers out here in Hollywood. There's enough directors out here in Hollywood. What they want is new, fresh, genuinely original, genuinely unique, bespoke voices. And I want that as a producer. I can feel it when I read new scripts. And, you know, we all know how to write the tricks of a script. We all know the structure of a script. It's not enough to just write something that's solid. You have to write something that makes people feel like, oh, this is a new voice. And so it's trust your voice, trust your vision. Don't try to copy other people's voices and visions because they're working.
And last question, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film industry or in life?
Wow. Balance. I think balance is something that took me a very long, 48 years old. And I would say I just learned that, and I'm still learning it. But I just learned it in the last few years with a 2-year-old baby and a 4-month-old baby.
Oh, God bless you.
Oh, I know. I hope God does. I'm counting on it. You know, I think for a very long time, I was so focused on my work. I felt like, you know, I'll have time when I take a break from my work to take care of my life. And, my work just kept rolling. And, you know, I moved from country to country and movie to movie and set to set. And that's wonderful on the one hand, but on the other hand, it hurts two things. One is obviously it hurts your life. Because, you know, if you want to be in a real relationship or a real family, it's harder. It's harder on them and it's harder on the bonds. But it's also, it hurts you as an artist because you start recycling your old ideas instead of actually living in the world and coming up with new ideas. And so that balance is something that I'm still learning, but it is the lesson that comes first to mind when you ask that question. It's a good question.
Thank you, Simon, so much for being on the show. And where can people and when can people see 355?
This Friday, January 7th, it will be in theaters. I hope people go see it.
Simon, thank you again for being on the show. And thank you for making some amazing films along the way of your career and continue doing so, sir. So thank you so much.
I appreciate it. I appreciate all your questions and your support. I really do.
Thank you, my friend.
Okay, take care.
Take care.
Bye.
I want to thank Simon so much for coming on the show and dropping his knowledge bombs on the tribe today. Thank you so much, Simon. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/166. And if you haven't already, please head over to screenwritingpodcast.com, subscribe, and leave a good review for the show. It truly helps us out a lot. Thank you again for listening, guys. As always, keep on writing no matter what. Talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv.